And I don't like repeating myself, but I'll repeat myself from a week or two ago. I once had a problem. I'm a big fan of fan dipoles, and unfortunately, I get a lot of wind here. And at one point, the wind kind of smacked the mast all over the place, and a whole bunch of legs of my fan dipole popped away. Although the VNA showed me that my antenna was worthless, I was still able to, quote, adjust my antenna tuner for a one-to-one standing wave ratio. My reception stunk. My transmission stunk. But I did have a reasonably good standing wave ratio thanks to my PALSTAR antenna tuner. So, again, antenna tuners, very useful. Love them. Wouldn't work without them, but you got to keep in mind what's going on because there are other ways that your antenna can malfunction with a perfectly fine VisWa.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
Well, you know, back in the 70s, I was able to work the world on CW. I had a dipole on every band. There's one for 80, one for 40, and 15. One for 20, one for 10. You know, I didn't really like so much to fix them or to do alteration to them. I wanted to spend most of my time working the stations and having the QSOs, you know? I have to say that I'm also a fan of dipoles, and I tied mine up there, and it hasn't moved for about 5 years. It just sits there, you know? I don't always get the perfect SWR, but it's good enough through the tuner for adequate transmission to different parts of the world. So, yeah, you know, antennas are great, but I wouldn't spend too much of my time working on them or talking about them. I would just make the conversations, you know?
Why am I thinking about somebody named Anne Rand?
Ed, why would you ever think about Ayn Rand? Such a terrible, terrible woman.
Not the one with the
sand there. No. Ayn Rand is the libertarian who made it legitimate for everyone to be a selfish bastard.
Oh, yes. So what was the name of the fan dance?
That's a great trivia question. I'm sure there's someone out there that remembers it. I'm drawing a blank right now. Who is the famous lady who did the fan dance?
Well, you know, if you want to make the world a better place, start with yourself and say, well, I'm going to be more generous, I'm going to be less selfish, and I'm going to consume less.
I hope that people have the same mindset that you do, David. Unfortunately, there's a lot of selfish people out there. And for the audience, the lady's name was very close. It was Sally Rand.
Sorry.
KD2FIU.
Okay, Chet first and then George.
Thank you, Roy. Here's another thing, too. That the gentleman was saying that his antenna wasn't optimum. He was really doing well on 40 meters. Although 2 days ago, there was a big pile up on 40, and I don't have much of an antenna at this end, and yet I got a beautiful report from a station, DX station, and I went to the QRZ to look him up, and I found out that he had a 136-foot tower with a four-element 40-meter beam, and he was doing all the work because he was picking me up. It wasn't because my signal was so good, but he had such a great receiving site, so that made the difference.
Yeah, that's not uncommon at all. I remember I'm the net control operator for another club's 10-meter net on Sunday morning, by the way, at 11 o'clock on 28.380, if anyone's interested. For a while, I noticed that we were getting guys, this was during sunspot minimum. We were still getting guys out there in Florida. And it was only after a while that I looked these guys up on QRZ and figured out that they had monstrous setups, that it was not my Serio 2016 doing most of the work. So sometimes it's life makes it easier if you have conversations with guys who have invested thousands of dollars into their antenna systems.
KD2VHD.
Yes, VHD.
Oh, Roy, good to hear you again. I just wanted to comment that it was kind of fun tonight. I came in late, but I stepped into a philosophy net and it turned into a ham tech net. I've been enjoying the conversation.
Who would have thunk it, right, Jim? Sometimes we go around and we get back to the beginning.
Great to hear. I'll be listening.
Okay, very good. George, you wanted to say something. George, KD2FIU, I thought you wanted to say something on the subject. Well, perhaps I was mistaken. Anyone else who wants to comment on this particular subject, I would like to add, though, intersecting this particular portion of space-time, I just want to mention on my link page that I don't know if everyone know who Joel Hallis was, W1ZR. He was a very clever guy, an amateur radio operator. He wrote for the ARRL and QST and had the column The Doctor Is In and had podcasts with that name. And I listened to it every single episode, and it was a joy to listen to him offer up his wisdom and experiences through many, many, many years. And our own Dick, K2RIW, had a bit of a email exchange with him about a year or two before Dick passed away as well and became a silent key. So unfortunately, Joel Hallis, W1ZR, passed away, I think, about a week ago. He was about 78 years old. And ARRL has a new columnist, a guy named Dave, and I hope he's anywhere near as good as Joel Hallis was. So I just wanted to advise you people, you know, some of you read QST cover to cover, so you know him well, and others have just heard him mentioned by Dick in past technical nets. So once again, anyone who has any comments on the previous subject, please hit that push to talk button. Okay, gone. We can have another 6 minutes of pre-SpaceNet report. So if anyone has any other questions of a technical, scientific, or medical question, all things being equal, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KG2RY, David.
Yes, David.
Was it 2 or 3 weeks ago I asked you a question in the email and you said that we should present this to the TechNet? And I'll just say what it is. You don't have to spend so much time on it. It's about the booster vaccination for the COVID-19. Is it advisable to take the booster? And is it safe? Go ahead. Even though I already took it.
Okay, very good, David. That's an excellent question. I mentioned that in an email exchange that we had a few weeks ago. The problem is that not all vaccinations last a lifetime. Your tetanus booster, usually your doctor will give you one every 10 years because of the nature of that vaccine only really protects you for about 10 years. There are vaccines that last a lifetime. There are vaccines that last a very small amount of time. Influenza vaccines, at best, are about 40 to 50% effective a few weeks after you've taken them, and by about 120, 150 days thereafter, they're completely useless. It's just the way the immune system works. So the coronavirus that we're dealing with was called a novel virus because it was a new virus, and nothing much was known. We don't really know what its herd immunity percentage is. And we don't know how any given vaccine will last over time unless we watch it over time and measure it. And this is what's been happening. Now, we talked earlier about this. There were some preliminary studies that included bone marrow aspirations that gave a much better way of judging the immunity of the vaccines. Most people don't really want to submit to a bone marrow aspiration. It's a painful and uncomfortable thing. So what has been going on is just people testing for the titers of antibodies and for the incidence of recurrence of infection. Let me drop for a sec. A lot of the research has taken place in Israel. They made a very aggressive move to vaccinate people, and so they were in a good position to do some studies. And based on those studies, it demonstrated that there is a decrease in immunity. Johnson & Johnson probably has the most rapid decrease in immunity, and some people, in hindsight, suggest that probably the Johnson & Johnson should have been given in a two-dose version, the same way that the Pfizer and the Moderna was. So we found out that immunity drops approximately anywhere from 50 to 70% immunity 6 months after your second shot. And so to top yourself back up to around 95 requires another booster. In the case of Moderna, a half of a dose is all that's necessary. There are no indications presently of any serious side effects to the vaccine in general and to the booster in particular. A lot of people have taken the booster, including David and myself and many, many others of you, hopefully. And except for a little sore arm, I felt nothing. I didn't even feel the slight one day of not feeling quite right that I had with the second of the first two shots of the Moderna. So it has proven itself to be incredibly safe. I have heard people yattering on the hand bands, making stuff up about all kinds of things that they have no proof whatsoever. The studies are out there. You can review them to your heart's content. It is a wise person who gets the booster and improves their immunity. Don't know how the Omicron variant is going to figure in. It's still going to take weeks to figure that out, though. Any comments? I'm particularly pleased that I didn't time out the repeater.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, Roy, the coronavirus that we're currently dealing with, it's similar to the common cold virus, isn't it? And
it is in a broad collection of viruses called coronaviruses. Most coronaviruses are seen in bats and other mammals, members of the cat family, all kinds of interesting pangolins and such. One version of it kind of became adjusted to infect humans with a far less mortality. The old coronavirus version of the common cold has a negligible morbidity and mortality, whereas COVID-19 has anywhere from a 1 to 2%. Influenza has something like 0.1%.
KD2WOT. But I guess that there really is no, you know, lasting or permanent immunity, you know, from having had a common cold. Why would we expect that there would be a lasting immunity from having had or being vaccinated with this virus?
Well, as I mentioned before, they are related distantly, but there's a lot of different sequences going on. The fundamental connection is their structural form. They give you the same silhouette. That's why they're called coronaviruses, because they have a kind of a crown. But the RNA that makes them up is probably significantly different, to the point where you can't really depend upon one behavior being the same as the other behavior. You could make a case for it, but you know, it's not conclusive. So I would agree with you. Again, one of the nonsensical things I've heard on the ham bands is some nonsense that normal exposure to the virus offers 20 times the immunity of a vaccine. Again, I don't know what orifice this guy pulled that factoid out of, but I wish people who didn't know anything would only talk about what they know. I realize the airwaves would be more quiet.
WB2AV.
Yes, Ed.
I am going to try to predict the future. Check back with me in about 2 years. We get a flu shot every year. I predict starting in 2023, 2024, the flu shot will include a COVID-19 booster as one of the elements of it.
Now, that's an interesting prediction. It is not beyond belief. I don't know if the preparations are capable, because you have to, again, remember that influenza doesn't require the temperature requirements of the Moderna and the Pfizer, so there might be a problem with that. But influenza vaccines are inherently multivalent. In other words, they cover for different strains of influenza. So it is not ridiculous to suggest that they'll incorporate a COVID variation in a annual influenza shot. So you might be right. We'll see.
Well, I'm giving you a couple of years to answer your questions.
Okay. I don't know if it's a strategic, if it would be a strategic problem to solve, or it's a temperature issue, because right now influenza vaccines don't really require too much preparation or storage. They don't have the problems that the current generation of messenger RNA vaccines warrant.
Oh, and one other thing. You're right.
Yes, one thing. One more thing.
Yeah, when I get home from getting my COVID-19 booster, the kitchen light bulb burned out. I'm sure it's related.
I'm sure it's related. One of the silliest things that I have seen on cable, and I have seen far too many silly things, are people who go to these to speak out in front of political bodies, and they keep on trying to stick a spoon, which is probably not ferromagnetic, to their sweaty chest to prove that they become magnetized due to the vaccination.
Wait a minute, I thought it was keys, which are made out of brass. Do you imagine the value of a brass magnet for garbage recycling?
I am always intrigued by the level of people's possible stupidity. So not only do they not know anything about virology, immunology, and biology, but they don't have the faintest idea even how magnets work.
No, seriously, about spoons. They're made of stainless steel. Once upon a time, my brother was working on a project and had to do an exhaustive research on which stainless steels are magnetic and which aren't. So it depends on the type of spoon.
Yes, that's true. Steel is iron and a little bit of carbon. Stainless steel includes other metals. Some metals do not impact on the ferromagnetic quality of the iron, and others neutralize it entirely.
Stainless has a lot of nickel in it. Remember, you probably don't remember, but back in the 1800s, the big thing was nickel-plated revolvers. That was kind of like a cheap and dirty attempt at stainless steel.
Oh, okay. I'm unaware. I haven't really researched the history of guns that much. I have an interest in them. I even subscribed to Guns and Ammo for 2 years, just out of curiosity. And I noticed that after about 1 year, they were repeating the same articles. So either the people subscribed to Gun and Ammo don't read, or there just isn't that much material on the subject.
Question.
Yes, what's the question?
This is Jim, KD2VHD. I appreciate everything being said. Interesting stuff. Can we have an example of some other mRNA vaccine, whatever you want to call it, that have been successful?
Yeah, I could barely make out that call sign. I got echo.
I take it it's not all quieting. Of an mRNA vaccine type of thing that has been successful?
Roy, I can hear him.
Okay, what's his call sign then?
The station, come back with comment.
Hey, thanks a lot. I haven't contributed in a long time. It's John here, N2JKZ, so November 2 in Juliet, Cuba Victor. I just wanted to throw something in there that nobody's really discussed. I am not a big fan of messenger RNA vaccine. It's too much risk, in my opinion, because what happens is if a lot of it is not contained in the deltoid, what happens is it could spread systemically, and then the mRNA can get into other somatic cells like your brain, like your heart, and cause those to produce spike protein, and then the body starts attacking those tissues. But anyway, my point is that we should really start to talk about the Novavax vaccine, which is going to be a protein subunit vaccination, which is spike protein made through moth larvae, and it'll be a million times safer than this mRNA that's out now.
Okay, John. When it's released, I'll open it up for a conversation. Getting back to Jim, there is no messenger RNA a vaccine prior to this that has been commercially manufactured and used to a large extent. Messenger RNA technology has been in research for 15, 20 years, but this is the first practical attempt at utilizing the technology to produce these vaccines in production levels. So the answer is there's none before it because this is the first two. John, I would tend to disagree with you. It sounds as though you've confused the spike protein with the full virus. The full virus, if it gets into your cell, will replicate because the full virus has RNA. The spike protein without the rest of the virus has no more RNA. The RNA was in the cell that got the vaccine that manufactured the spike protein. So there's nothing in the spike protein capable of reproduction. It's simply a key to a lock. Once it turns the key, it's not delivering anything because it doesn't have anything else on it.
Yep, I'm fully versed on it. I know quite a lot about it. What I'm saying is I would rather have finished product, spike protein made externally in limited quantities, injected into my deltoid, rather than have mRNA with instructions to make spike protein. The problem is if it goes beyond your deltoid, it's not just your deltoid that's becoming a factory to create the spike. It's going systemically all over your body, and it ends up in your brain or your heart or other places. Those tissues will absorb the mRNA, make the spike protein, and then you've got your body potentially attacking all those other diverse organs and tissues. So I'm going to welcome the Novavax when it comes out.
Okay, all well and good. Again, I'm having problems with that line where you say, and it makes more spike protein. A spike protein has no way to make more spike proteins. The only way that the human body can make more spike proteins is with the messenger RNA or the original RNA of the virus. Without that, if you place the spike protein in a cell, it sort of just sits there and then gets eaten up, because there is no replication capability. Proteins don't replicate proteins. RNA replicates proteins.
Yep, I fully know that. Believe me, I fully know that. What I'm saying is that the messenger RNA, when it goes into various tissues beyond the intended, say, deltoid, and it goes into these other tissues, if you've got brain cells, heart cells, absorbing that mRNA, it gives the instructions to that particular tissue, and then that tissue starts churning out, you know, by way of the ribosome, churning out spike proteins that go to the surface of those tissues, then your antibodies will be attacking those tissues, and it depends on the individual. Some people, it could cause inflammation, and it's just too risky. This technology is not the best technology. They should have just done it right and did the protein subunit vaccine like Novavax from the get-go. It's hard to do that. It's fast.
Okay, so pray tell, what's your opinion of the Johnson & Johnson? It does not use messenger RNA.
Exactly. Yep. What it does is they encapsulate DNA for the same instructions for spike protein. They encapsulate that into an adenovirus, which then conveys that to your cell, and it pretty much, you know, does a similar thing in that respect. So I'm just saying that I think the better vax is the protein subunit, which is going to be coming out in the next couple months.
Okay, time will tell. We will ultimately see if there are any side effects. Thankfully, so far there is no indication, but we will see. I still think that people should use what's available right now, rather than wait and for something better to come along. You can see in the statistics of the shift in hospitalizations and mortality are highly dependent upon population vaccination records and such. In South Africa, where may or may not Omicron popped into existence, there's a very low vaccination percentage, and so there's a great breeding ground. But we'll find out. I'm open to new technology. I'm not against it. The more information and more technology is always better than less. Anyone with any comments? I'd like to close this off because I didn't think I was going to take up this much time with this question.
Steve?
Yes, Rich.
Quickly, I'm wondering why, what is it about COVID that has made it so hard to eradicate? It seems like COVID is particularly, now this is to a completely lay person, that COVID virus is tougher than other ones that have come along, at least in my lifetime. Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, you know, all viruses have different different abilities to infect. You know, some things are very infectious. Some things are not infectious at all. COVID-19 is relatively very infectious. The Delta variant is even more infectious. The amount of shedding particles is much higher than the original version of this virus. So it's just a matter that we live in a densely populated world with a lot of easy transportation and a lot of stubborn people. So you put all that together, and unfortunately, you get a great deal of infections.
Infective, is that a word, infective, or is it infectious?
Well, this is more grammar than medicine or biology. I would kind of fudge it and say infectivity, if there's such a word, because infectious does not denote degree. Something that's a little infectious and something that's a lot infectious is both called infectious.
What does shedding mean?
Shedding means the amount of viral particles that you can infect someone else with. If all you did was shed, say, two viruses an hour, you wouldn't give it to anyone. If you shed tens of thousands of viral particles every minute or 10 minutes, it's much more likely that one of them is going to reach a sensitive spot. Most infections are based upon mucous membranes, so the nostrils, the mouth, and the eyes are where a lot of exposure. The spike proteins are designed to attach to the membranes cell of mucous membranes, and that's where they get their first stranglehold on the body.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a general internist.
Oh, so you're really a doctor. Okay. Push me back. Thank you.
You're welcome. I guess you thought it was just kind of an honorific, like Joe Hallis with the doctor is in?
No, I thought you were like, I thought you were talking a bunch of crap, but if you say you're a doctor, then I give you get some props.
Don't mess with Roy. He is the ultimate Renaissance man.
KV2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
Just one other point, Dr. Roy, and that's the fact that it's spread asymptomatically, which I think is a big problem.
I don't want to talk about this. All right, good night, fellas. I'll be back.
KD2DOA.
6 Hills, Long Island
Hill. Okay. Your option. There's always that off button. Matter of fact, I'm going to turn this conversation off because I don't want to push poor Paul farther down the time stream. I just want to mention that, yeah, there is a lot of silent shedding. And fortunately for the individuals, not everyone ends up in a hospital. Some people don't have any symptoms whatsoever. Some people have mild symptoms, and they can all shed and become infectious to other people, and it spreads, and then it spreads, and then it spreads. So, yeah, one of the problems is just because you're feeling fine doesn't necessarily mean you weren't infected and you aren't infectious.
Oh, so you're not a vet. I thought you were a vet, boy.
No, some veterinarians think that the veterinarians are higher up in the food chain. So, and they're very smart people, and they work with more than one species. So who knows? But I thank everyone for the kind words and giving me a pass because I've been practicing medicine for 40 years, so they're assuming I know something about the subject, which is nice of them. Anyway, it's been fun. I loved it. I hope we can do it again next Sunday night, but it's really, really time for Paul, WS2N and the SpaceNet Report. So I'll be talking again later on, but until then, here's Paul.
ACTGDS, WS2N, great net so far. Roy, very, very well done. Good topics. And the first thing I wanted to talk about is this EVA that was done, the spacewalk that was done by two astronauts that happen to be ham radio operators, Tom Washburn, KE5HOC, and Kayla Barron, KI5LAL. They went out to change out an antenna on the International Space Station. It was delayed for a while because of space junk, and first time that ever occurred, where they decided to hold off on an EVA because of a possible debris flying by. But they held off for a couple of days, but they went out and successfully changed out this antenna that had failed. You know, so we think of going out and why is this a 6-hour deal to go out and just change, take an antenna and disconnect it? When I first heard it, I said, well, wonder what's involved. So I looked into it quite a bit, and I found out what they're changing out is this S-band antenna. It's called the S-band antenna support assembly, and it weighs like 250 pounds. And it's got multiple parts to it. They have two such types of units on the International Space Station. One is on the port side, one is on the starboard side of the space station. The trusses are laid out in numbers. There's truss 0, truss 1, truss 3, 4, 5, and then there's going the other way. They have truss numbers as well. And this one was on the port side. And it wouldn't transmit. It could receive, but it wasn't transmitting. Naturally, they have multiple antennas on the space station. They have backup systems. This one's S band, and they have KU band. So they held off on changing this out. They noticed it degraded a while back, but they held off for a while until they had time for the EVA. But, it consists of a horn type of S-band that's gimbaled. They have this AZL type rotator setup, similar to what you would have, here on Earth, except this is space rated. So it changes in azimuth, changes in elevation. They've got this big power unit with a radiator on it to reflect the heat out into space. And the thing was about 7 feet long and about 250 pounds, bolted up to this truss of the space station. Now, what we did is Roy was good enough to put it up onto his website to see what I'm talking about. You could look at this antenna. And see that this is not just a simple thing to disconnect. It's got all kinds of power connectors. I think there's at least three cables that had to be disconnected. Coax type cables. But if you go to roy.ac2gs.com and scroll down a little bit, and you'll see the picture that's been posted. I labeled everything to let you know what we're looking at, including part of it. The system is also a low-gain antenna that's also located there. But anyway, they went out successfully, like I said, over six and a half hours to change this out. This thing works roughly 2 to 6 gigahertz as far as frequency goes. And they don't really use it too much for video going down, but they do a lot of telemetry through this, a lot of science projects, 300 science projects on the station. You know, they transmit information constantly down to the Earth. So without this, they would be in trouble. I mean, they had a backup, but they need this operating. It failed around 2000, I think 2006 or so. They had one antenna like this fail, and they did a similar type of swap with the antennas. They have these storage locations on the International Space Station in multiple places, and it's attached to the outside of the space station on these truss sections, and they have all kinds of equipment, that extra stuff that they thought they might need in the future when the space shuttle was operating. So to give you an idea, the new antenna has been actually sitting up there. The last space shuttle that went up was 2011, so they've been sitting up there for a while, and they have plugs that are plugged into it on these storage facilities on the outside of the space station, because they need to keep these things in good shape. So some equipment has data connections. This one had a heating connection connected to it. So you take one astronaut, you put him on the end of a robotic arm. Canada arm, they call 57-foot robotic arm. They attach him to that, and then he's working with Kayla, who's not attached to an arm, and they work together to disconnect this antenna system, the broken one, attach it to the external platform, and then disconnect the new one. They have to bring that back and reinstall that, and then they also have to go back to the old one and really bolt it up. When they first bring it over, they call it soft dock and hard dock. They put it on close enough, and then later on they maneuvered back or translated back to that location and really bolted everything up. So congratulations to those two hands for successfully changing out the S-band system. Let me drop it, see if there's any questions before we move on. This is WS2M. Again, my name here is Paul.
Paul, Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. On a different subject, did you see that documentary on the building of Perseverance on Paramount Plus?
I'd like to. I don't get Paramount Plus, so I did not see that one. But, I've studied Perseverance quite a bit. Do you have any questions about it or comments? How was it? How was the documentary?
One of the most fascinating pieces of film I've ever seen. They made the clean room so clean that it caused friction on a particular part, which scrubbed the mission a couple of times, just because, I guess, the cleaner you make something, the more friction it creates when it comes in contact with something else. But I'd love you to see it. It's excruciating. A $2 billion project, and the fascinating thing about it is they have three levels of assembly, and the final assembly team... project, I guess any one of these projects, and they're really something special, these guys. They've been vetted 1,000 times over to be the final assembly of Perseverance and probably any spacecraft. So that's all. I just wanted to know if you've seen it, Doris.
No. I've seen documentaries on that, on Perseverance and the helicopter Ingenuity and all. Did they bring up the topic of the helicopter?
Yeah, they had a whole separate section on the helicopter, and the woman who was the lead scientist on developing the helicopter.
Yeah, she's great. I'm trying to think of her name. But, anytime they interview anybody, she's the one that gets to talk about it. Involved with it for quite a few years, and it turned out to be very successful. They were hoping to fly it 5 times. That was the plan, 5 times. They were already up to flight number 14, going on number 15. It went from a test, let's see if it works, you know. It's a naturally battery-operated system, but it does have a solar panel on top to recharge the batteries. Six batteries that are inside that thing. On Earth, it weighs a little over 4 pounds. The blades are, almost 4 feet long. Two blades that spin, one clockwise, one counterclockwise. And they were hoping to demonstrate that they could fly this thing in something that was 1/100th the atmosphere of Earth. And sure enough, it did work. It flies for, the early flights were, 30 seconds or so, and then they extended them to a minute and 2 minutes now. But I think it's almost 3 minutes now. They're able to fly. They go higher, further. They think nothing of going like the length of a football field or two football fields. It went from an experimental system. Then they said after flight number 5, it actually became operational, helping Perseverance out and all. Giving Perseverance a head up on what's ahead. And they've already made some adjustments to the path Perseverance is taking due to the pictures that Ingenuity takes. It has two cameras on board, one looking down, a black and white camera that looks down, and that they use that to navigate, make sure it doesn't land on a big rock when it comes back down. And that goes off with 30 frames per second. And each one is analyzed before it makes. You couldn't control this. Even if you were on Mars, you wouldn't be able to control this. It has to be done by a computer. They actually tried it on Earth. They put it in that vacuum chamber in California, JPL, and they tried to actually fly it, and they crashed it a number of times. But when they let the computer do it, it flies very good. But they're going to get a lot of science back from Perseverance. Of course, this is the second nuclear-powered vehicle that we've had up there. I wonder if they talked about Curiosity. That thing is still driving around on Mars since 2012. Back to you, Ed.
I think there's a separate documentary on Curiosity, but they refer to it very little. I was surprised. And I think the drone took 4 years from conception to production, and I think that's how long it took, 4 years nonstop, almost 24/7. Imagine, the man hours in building a drone. And the other thing that surprised me, there were many women who were in management position on building Perseverance, maybe also Curiosity, maybe all throughout the space program, but I don't think you find that ratio in regular corporate America. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it said, yeah, the one that's running, she was born in, I think they said either Thailand or Malaysia. I don't know, but anyway, she's been in the States, you know, forever. And she was a head engineer and wound up running the whole program. So she's got a whole crew that's involved with her, with Ingenuity. Very good. Okay, thanks for that. I'll look for, I'd look for any documentaries. Hopefully, maybe they'll release that particular one to, regular broadcast. I'm looking forward to a documentary. I'm sure they're going to have one with the flight of the telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope. I would imagine NOVA will have something. I haven't seen anything advertised about it yet, but NOVA always does great. I'm sure they'll probably have that. But yeah, you're right about the price. I think it was $2.5 billion for Perseverance. And it's about the same size, a little bit bigger than Curiosity, roughly 10 by 10. And the mast stands about 7 feet high. It hits the rocks, and through that process, they're able to also record the through a spectroscope, figure out what those rocks are made of. And actually, Curiosity had a similar type of setup, as well as Perseverance. Very good. Thanks for that, Ed. Let me just continue on here to another topic while I have time. I really wanted to cover this. Stand by. Okay, and this is WS2N for ID. I did get one email from AC2LR. She sent me a story about the there's an astronomy club in Tucson, Arizona, and they were going to have a meeting that was going to talk about this project. They called SAM Squared. SAM Squared, it's an analog system for going to the moon and Mars. How to survive on the moon or Mars. They call it SAM, S-A-M Squared, SAM Squared, or Space Analog for Moon and Mars. You know, you get a S for the space, A for analog, for moon, M, and Mars, another M, so they have S-A-M. The SAM Squared, so this Tucson astronomy group, they were having this meeting. Anybody could have watched what was going on. There was this presentation about SAM Squared, and I don't have Facebook. You need Facebook to do that. But anyway, I was familiar with this, the material. SAM Squared is what they're going to do is they're going to take four people, put them in a building. It's in Arizona, and seal it off, you know, completely seal it off, and it's going to be like another biosphere. It's taking place on the grounds of Biosphere 2. Biosphere 2 started in late 80s. In the early 90s, they actually took eight people and put them in this multi-dome building setup, I think it was like around 6 or 7 acres, and that whole thing was completely sealed off. And the idea was see if they could survive in there for 2 years, which they did. A lot of problems, things went on, but the eight people actually did stay in there for 2 years. And you know, the idea was that, you know, if we're going to go to the moon or Mars, we're going to be able to, we need to have these, a facility like this. And, you know, can we grow plants? Can we, you know, this thing have like an ocean in it and all? And anyway, Biosphere 2, after that, they had two missions back in the 90s. After that, they stopped doing it. Eventually, University of Arizona took over the facility. But here we are all these years later, and they're going to take one small building that they used as a test facility in the late 80s. They actually took one person, they put them in here, in this one small building, to see if he would last like a month in there. And he didn't, and because that was successful, they built this $200 million project. A fellow named Ed Bass, some guy with a lot of money, it was one of these, I don't know, do you want to call him a philanthropist or somebody that really believed in science and all, and he poured all this money into this project. And so now this thing is, they're actually going to try this again. They have a facility on the outside that they made look like a Mars landscape, so when they, you know, if they want to go out for a walk, they'll put a spacesuit on and they'll go out and walk around out there. You know, trying to duplicate what it's like on Mars. There's other facilities. NASA has done this. Different colleges and universities participated, and they have one set up like, you know, similar to this in Hawaii. I think another one. In Utah, they have another one. And this type of thing, they're always having crews go in and see how long they could stay. But this one, it's going to be more sealed off. They're going to have it where they're going to try to grow plants and all and see how that goes. But I was always fascinated with this Biosphere 2, they call it. And if you ever want to read a good book, it's called The Human Experiment, 2 Years and 20 Minutes by Jane Poynter. She was one of the eight people that went into this Biosphere 2. Lived there for 2 years, actually 2 years and 20 minutes, and hence the name of the book. But it gives you a whole layout of, you know, what went on years before and how she, you know, got involved with this group, and then naturally, step by step, almost like a diary of what went on in those 2 years. And one of the guys she was in there with, she eventually married the one guy, and they actually went into business afterwards as the years went on.
That time complete.
Started Space Perspective. Company out in Arizona that even today they're still planning on building balloons big enough to carry what looks like a spaceship, but it's a gigantic enclosed gondola on the back, on the bottom of the this big helium balloon, and they plan on bringing people up to the stratosphere, you know, the 18, 19 miles high, and then eventually bring them back, you know, eight people at a time. In a sealed-off environment. But they're actually involved with that project. They've done actual work for NASA, too, where working with developing spacesuits and stuff like that. But it's a great book. I highly, highly recommend it. Any comments or questions, WS2. Okay, let me see. There's another flight going off. Today's what, Sunday? Yeah, tomorrow morning, I think, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning or something. There's a rocket going up, an Atlas V, the biggest version of the Atlas V that NASA launches. You know, they're putting up 5 solid boosters.